Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
All right. Hey, everybody. My name is Bill Tarr, and I'm a SaaS evangelist for the AWS SaaS Factory. And today, I have the privilege of being joined by Todd Golding to discuss his new book. So, Todd, why don't you take a second, introduce yourself, tell us about the book that you've just written. Give us a title and maybe where people can start come find it right out of the gate so we can leave them with the takeaways right in the beginning. What do you think?
Sure. That's a great place to start. Thanks, Bill, for doing this, by the way. And as Bill said, my name's Todd Golding, and I've been working on sort of SaaS problems at AWS for the last 8+ years in this domain. And I guess, I don't know how long ago it's been, maybe a year and a half or so ago, I decided, we've been publishing in this space long enough. We've been in this space long enough that it was, and we've written about a bunch of it, that it sort of seemed like it was a moment where we're like, we should put this in a book. This belongs in a book. And I'd written a book before, but I swore I'd never write another one again. And yet here I sort of dove into this. And so with O'Reilly, we published Building Multi-Tenant SaaS Architectures book earlier this year. And the reception has been fairly positive to that. And I'm sort of just happy that we're sort of beyond the moment of publishing and now talking more about what's in the book and what value I hope it brings.
So Todd, I heard you just say, you said you'd never write another book. So I imagine as you were thinking about writing this book, because you've written white papers, you've given speeches, you've done everything you could possibly do on SaaS. Who did you have in mind that you thought really needed this book that we weren't really speaking to yet with all the other media that we're producing?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, the challenge of having published so many things and done so many talks was that it felt like it was sort of scattered all around the universe, and that people could find bits and pieces of the thing they wanted are in a very targeted area, and they could go into any one topic and sort of get that targeted guidance for that one subject. But there was nothing that sort of cohesively sort of connected the whole story end to end and tried to tell it end to end. It was kind of piecemeal before that. So for me, when I wrote the book, I was thinking, well, there's all these builders, developers, architects, and to some degree, even business people, product owners, I think, who have heard elements of this story along the way, but not heard it told in an end-to-end fashion. And I felt like being able to sort of tell that story in that manner let me target these builders and these developers, who are a lot of them who might be at the very front of sort of figuring out SaaS, others who are already have a SaaS solution, but I don't know where to start or thinking about making it a better SaaS solution. And I could come at this problem more comprehensively and really walk the entire service of the problem and find the bits of it that would help me apply that to my solution. So I think it's really the target here is anyone who's building SaaS with clearly a heavy leaning towards architects and developers and that universe. But there are chapters in there that would absolutely say, if I'm a business leader or I'm a product owner in a SaaS space, I probably should be thinking about these things as part of looking at how I connect what I do to what the tech side of the house is doing.
And that absolutely makes sense, Todd. Just sort of the unwinding all of these different individual pieces. Now, as you think about how the flow of this evolved over time, was there some piece of the conversation that actually came way later than you thought it would? As I was flipping through the chapters, I saw tenant isolation was chapter 9. And I was like, wait, that's the first thing that we usually talk about when we come into customers. And I see that you changed some of the language, or the things like that surprised you about how the flow evolved as you wrote a book about it.
The flow is really challenging for this book for me because I certainly want to get to the tech topics. I want to get into the weeds of the interesting technical bits of this problem. At the same time, and I know you and I have offline talked about this, there's this foundation of knowledge and sort of this mental model and this this sort of vision for what it really means to be SaaS and being unified around that, having this base that is like this common value system for what it means to be SaaS was, I thought, essential to like telling the rest of the story. So as when I get to tenant isolation or I get to data partitioning and I get to these other subjects, I really wanted to be able to say like these build on that broader foundation. So for me, those things did come later in the book than I thought they would come. But I was still happy that where they landed and where they ended up. Obviously, if you're somebody who just wants to jump right into those super meaty topics right away, you're going to jump ahead in the book probably, and that's all good. But I even say in parts of the book at the beginning, like, if you don't have this common foundation, like, because there are many people with many different definitions of what SaaS is and using different terminology, all these other challenges that we've faced as we've engaged different companies who are building SaaS. And if you don't have that common base, then when you wander into these depth topics, there's confusion because they're like, well, what do you mean when you say silo, or what do you mean pool, or what do you mean when you're talking about tenant isolation? Is that just a deployment model, or what is it? So that was sort of core to me, to sort of setting the table, and is why so many of those things came later in the chapters of the book. But it's probably a surprise, especially to somebody who, like yourself, who also wanders in this topic.
Absolutely, Todd. And it's always refreshing to see how people reset when they think about a topic holistically. And you did start off, though, with the SaaS mindset. I feel like this is an important part of the conversation. Like, if you're speaking to the people who are listening right now and thinking about reading the book, where should they be starting in their thought process when they're thinking about building SaaS? And how does that initial, why did you start there to try to connect them with the real spirit of SaaS?
Yeah, it's almost been like a little bit of religion for me when I talk about the SaaS mindset, because I go into so many companies where there is this huge disconnect between the technical side of the house and the business side of the house about what it means to be SaaS. And they're struggling with those boundaries. Some businesses are just saying, like, go tech, go make us SaaS. We don't know what it is, but we want the economies of scale and we want the agility, so go do it. And that's a mistake. But then there are tech sides of the house who think, well, this is a tech problem only, and just we'll figure out a price it and sell it, but we don't need much else from the business, which is also a mistake, right? There's the other fundamental problem is people often think of SaaS through lots of different lenses, and we end up blurring what SaaS really is. We'll see MSP find its way into the discussion. We'll see lots of people will say they're SaaS, but are offering, doing one-off deployments and offering customizations, doing lots of things that sort of undermine what it means to be SaaS. And so for me, I wanted to put everybody in the same frame of mind about the fact that SaaS is a business model, and then SaaS is also B, it's about driving growth and agility and getting all the goodness of having one deployment for all customers that's managed and operated collectively through a single pane of glass. And then if you don't get that sort of base as part of your understanding, then it sort of erodes everything else going forward.
It's a great thought. And it also leads me into sort of the next thought of, as we've talked about SaaS over the years, Todd, I think one of the concepts that really has emerged and risen to the top is control planes.
Right.
So having a control plane and how you manage that. I noticed that you jump right into that after the SaaS mindset. I don't know if we always talked about it in that way, but can you sort of explain your thinking about the control plane and what it means for SaaS providers and how they should be thinking about it?
Yeah. The control plane was something that came to life over multiple years, right? I had people who, when we first started talking in this space, would talk about a control plane for SaaS, and I would be, I'm not sure. Is there really a control plane? Is there not a control plane? And then a few years ago, we just finally had enough pieces of the puzzle come together. We'd seen so many patterns out there that it became very clear that there was this need to be able to separate what's happening inside the application side of the house, where we're doing tenant isolation and data partitioning and all the things people mostly think about, from what it means to just collectively manage and operate all the moving parts of your SaaS environment. And so we definitely at that point made a big shift to start talking about the control plane and the app plane as the two halves of SaaS, of every SaaS solution. And that model, that distinction, brought a lot of clarity to the problem for teams, and also illustrated for teams the fact that they probably needed a control plane. They had pieces of a control plane, but hadn't openly acknowledged that they had that they really actually had a control plane. So it drove this value system of saying, well, what really is in your control plane? What is in your app plane? And what role are these two things playing? And what services belong where? How do where do you provision tenants, for example? Does that all happen in the control plane, or does some of that happen in the app plane? Like, it drove all these great questions. And so for me now, like, we just fundamentally, anytime we talk about SaaS environments, we're always talking about, well, what's in your control plane? What's in your app plane? And as we build sample solutions and reference architectures now, we draw this line between the control and the application planes. And customers and partners and other people we work with sit in rooms now, and you start talking about it, and they're like, oh, we have a control plane and we don't realize it, but we've never really called it a control plane. And because we didn't formalize that, we missed some of the nuance and the value we could have gotten out of that.
That's a great point. Now, one of the things you said, so we're talking about control plane and application plane. This is some of the terminology we've evolved. Another one of those pieces, and I saw so along the way somewhere in the book, I saw the blurb that we always say, which is the question about multi-tenancy and how we describe tenancy. Do you want to sort of dive into some of, maybe not even just multi-tenancy, what are some of those keywords that we've evolved in our terminology that you would want people to look for and connect to in this book?
Yeah, I feel like multi-tenancy, that phrase has so many roots in the history of technology. Yeah. And it got naturally attached to SaaS, but the problem is it had a history attached to it as well, right? Because so many people talked about multi-tenancy as just sharing infrastructure. And then, yes, SaaS was about sharing infrastructure, and they just said, oh, then they're the same thing. But the problem was SaaS itself isn't always about shared infrastructure. Sometimes tenants have dedicated infrastructure. Sometimes they have shared infrastructure. Yes, we want the economies of scale of shared infrastructure, but not every SaaS solution shares infrastructure. So not every SaaS solution is, in the classic sense of multi-tenant, really multi-tenant. So we had to rename and rethink the brand of multi-tenancy when we started talking about it in a SaaS context. Yes, we'll let everybody keep the old definition we had, but going forward, we said multi-tenancy has to be a bigger term. It has to be a broader scope. It has to say we are operating and running a business in a multi-tenant fashion, but allowing for the fact that some tenants will share resources and some will not, and we'll have a variety of deployment models inside of our environment, all under the umbrella of multi-tenancy. And this is where we then introduced new terms to try to overcome some of the challenges of multi-tenancy. So you'll see in the book all over the word silo and pool used left and right. And we intentionally introduced those terms because we needed to talk about dedicated infrastructure versus shared infrastructure separate from the notion of multi-tenancy. And so any resource that's shared is called pooled. Any resource that's dedicated is called siloed. And then we just allow for any granularity there and allow for the fact that in your architecture, some tenants may be running siloed and pooled. Some resources may be siloed and pooled. And we just, once we sort of adopted that terminology and detached from multi-tenancy, it made the rest of the discussion much easier. And even as I talk to customers about this, as soon as you do that, it like simplifies the whole discussion because they had something in their mind about it, but they were just saying multi-tenant for everything, but we were trying to parse it out, and this made it easier to parse all that out.
Yeah, and it continues as the conversation goes on. I feel like the language has evolved piece by piece, and one of the next things that I always hear for terminology, when we talk about onboarding, we talk about identity, I always hear us say frictionless onboarding and SaaS identity. And this sort of, again, continues to evolve from the control plane toward what we're building. You want to talk a little bit about those onboarding and identity stories and what they mean to you and what the reader should be looking for?
Yeah, onboarding is one of those interesting things, which is, to me, is at the epicenter of like starting a SaaS, the construction of a SaaS environment. And it's often the thing people put last are later in the process, which are like, yes, eventually we'll have to onboard multiple tenants, but right now we've got this working with one tenant, and we have these ways of like creating another tenant that are these manual things, and it'll let us get the system up and running. When in reality, to me, how a tenant gets introduced into your environment, how you automate all the moving parts of getting a tenant onboarded, how does it provision the unique sort of infrastructure elements that are needed? So how does it support tiering? How does it deal with setting up the billing? There are like lots of moving parts to this, including creating the tenant, creating their identity, and creating all the things that set the stage for tenant isolation potential in the future. And if you get the automation of that right, and you think about what it means to automate all of that early in your process, it drives all these sort of boundaries into the depth of your architecture. It makes you make choices in your architecture. And then going forward, it makes you think about, now I've got tenant context injected into everything I did because I've introduced this tenant, and I can introduce as many as I want. Now all the rest of my system has to think about, well, what does it mean to truly operate in a multi-tenant context now? How are logs going to work? How is operations going to work? How are all these sort of moving parts of multi-tenancy going to be here? And onboarding ends up being that forcing function of bringing all those moving parts to life, including the control plane and the app plane. Who owns what parts of onboarding in the control plane, and who owns what parts of onboarding in the app plane? Lots of good bits of that. So I always, in fact, if you see talks I did and they say, where would I start? Like, I would always start with like, how are we going to get onboarding to work? Even if the app barely does anything, at least we can start building that foundation.
Yeah. Let me pull back a minute from some of the implementation details here, because I love the detail, but I'm kind of curious, as a writer, was there something that you did in this book that you're particularly proud of? Something where you're like, wow, I never quite phrased this the right way, and I feel like I really said it right this time, and the reader's really going to feel, even if they've seen me at reInvent, even if they read my white papers, they're going to feel like they got something new out of this book.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come.
I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
I think it's not necessarily any one chapter or any one section of the book that I wrote that I would say like I really nailed that. I do feel like the luxury of taking a little more space to say things in a few places gave me the freedom to tell more stories and to make more analogies and to do things to make an idea go from concept to a little more concrete for people. So I think that was just the freedom of having more space to write. Did that for me across multiple topics. It was also more the connective tissue of you set it up well in this chapter, and then now had like, so if you look at tenant isolation has its tentacles into so many parts of the system. And before, when I had to write about tenant isolation, had to drag all those little pieces in with me to try to tell the story, but it sometimes convoluted it. So for me, being able to pull these concepts apart and tell them in sequence and then connect them to one another was the thing that felt like I was finally giving a better version of that story than I might have told before. So that's probably not I would love to say that the bit I wrote on some particular topic made me feel better. I will say that the last chapter of the book, actually, the guiding principles piece of that, I did feel like that was one of the first times I like tried in one place to sit down and just say, like, here are the things I would tell to a business at the highest level or to a technologist or an operations team that are like, you got to have these things on your radar. And I think those have been laced all over other things before. So putting them in one place maybe felt good.
Let me ask another sort of a high level question about this, because I've actually showed up in several customer meetings now. People have held up your book in the meeting and be like, yeah, I came prepared. I actually read the book. I've got the Bible already. So this is great. But you know, it's exactly what you'd hope for, right? That people are arriving at the table with a lot of this information you provide in the book. But perhaps, is there somebody you've gotten feedback from in particular that really, like, it shocked you, it surprised you, like, wow, I can't believe I actually, this landed in this person's lap. I can't believe that I'm hearing this feedback from about the book. Is there something that's really jumped out at you since you've written it?
Probably the some of the LinkedIn sort of private DMs I've got from people who picked up the book, people I've never talked to before, who are picking up the book and they're in some stage in their business of like trying to adopt SaaS. And I always knew that guidance, I guess, was helpful and it would help people get over hurdles and would help people sort of solidify their view of what it meant to be SaaS. But some of the feedback was like, it felt like, and I mean, obviously this is not just me doing anything fantastic. It's just connecting them to the knowledge, but it felt like people were like using the book to shape their whole new sort of vision and strategy of where they were going. And then it was more invasive into the broader strategy of companies in ways that I didn't expect. I thought sort of some technologists in a corner would get it and then go use it and sort of try to help the business to understand, hey, we got to be doing more of this. And, or now we know how to do data partitioning. And instead I saw people were like, we're rethinking our whole approach to this based on the book. And I don't think I expected that would happen with people. I knew maybe you'd get one or two of those, but I got more of those than I expected.
That's awesome. It's really good to hear. And I think we do hear this from customers sometimes that this is really helping to evolve their business. But let me kind of going back into some of the technical weeds, as I was thinking about the topics that struck me as maybe evolutionary in terms of what you've talked about before, tenant routing is something that I feel like we've always mentioned along the way, but you had a lot more detail in the book about the different options for tenant routing and how tenants flow into a multi-tenant system, right? Whether it's siloed or pooled. How did you feel about the evolution of that topic? Is that something that's been in your mind that you've been trying to get out in some way?
Yeah, it's a great question because tenant routing was we'd go build a serverless SaaS reference architecture. We'd go build an EKS one and you'd figure out kind of routing in there. And it would be a nuance of like, what are we going to do for routing for this particular architecture? But we never sort of pulled it out on its own and just said, wait a minute, this is a big decision actually as part of your multi-tenant architecture. And it has more complexity to it than I think we gave it credit for at the beginning. It's actually, you know, how are people coming in the front door of your application? Are they using subdomains? Are they not using subdomains? Or, well, like, how are they identifying tenants as they come in the front door? And then which stack you're in and how you're scaling and what deployment models you're using mean you may need all kinds of different techniques to successfully route. And how does that routing scale successfully? Like, there are so many choices. If you just stay in the EKS space alone, right, there's probably like 15 choices are just about how to deal with tenant context and how to route it. And are you doing namespace per tenant? Or are you using which kind of sort of partitioning and deployment model are you using? All those things, including back to identity, even like how do you route potentially and go force somebody to auth and then auth and get back in with the right tenant context and have all that happen seamlessly. I will say that is an area that I, now that you call it out, is one that I think wrote in more depth about than I'd written about before. We've done talks about it, but I don't think we put anything on paper. I definitely have a higher appreciation for what's involved there. And I do feel like the tech is moving so fast in that space. Like if you said to me, come back 2 years from now and do another edition of this book, I would bet that chapter would be heavily influenced by new things that had evolved and emerged in the space.
Yeah, I mean, even from my own experience recently, Todd, you and I have been talking a lot about cell-based architectures lately, and the routing layer of that is another new innovation. So do you want to speak a little bit to how you had, you know, we've sometimes called it pod-based, sometimes called it cell-based. As readers going into the book, I think this is another new topic that a lot of people are going to be sort of surprised about. Like, how should people be thinking about cell-based architectures, even without the routing? Just the plain theory of it, how would you position with them?
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up because very late in the book, I had this moment where I covered it. I called it pod-based architecture because we had all this history of calling it cell-based that had this baggage attached to it. And I'm going to, I think I'd go back and call that cell-based architecture now, but it's too late. And I'd probably make a whole separate chapter on cell-based architecture if I could, just because I feel like it's emerging as a really popular model for organizations, especially people who have a big global footprint. And I feel like cell-based architecture is a new way to think about scale and resilience for SaaS. It's not new for SaaS as much as it's a model we haven't emphasized a lot for SaaS. And I think for many, it's a way to sort of compartmentalize tenants into these groups, right? So if I take cells and I say, I'm going to take a set of tenants, I'm going to put one in a cell and it's some logical grouping of tenants, and I do another cell, and then cells become a unit of scale for my business. I deal with, well, now deployment only has to think about like, oh, the blast radius of affecting deployment to individual cells. The scaling policies are constrained to whatever scale is within that cell. And I can then build more creative ways to figure out how big should a cell be? How many tenants should be in it? What kind of tenants should it be? Well, I put my higher tier tenants in separate cells than my pooled tenants. So I feel like it just opens up a huge range of possibilities. And then it also opens up the ability to say, I want to be multi-region, or I want to span the globe. And the cell just becomes another unit of deployment to extend into those geographies.
That all makes a lot of sense, Todd. Let me jump back up again a level into the business conversation, though. So you said in the very beginning, SaaS is a business model, right? That heavily involves a business. We started with a SaaS mindset. Now we've talked to a bunch of technical topics that get pretty deep in terms of technology, cell-based architectures, routing. For anyone from the business side who happens to be listening, you know, if you're coming from finance, if you're coming from product, if you're coming from operations, and they're thinking, man, I don't connect with my technical teams. Like, I want to have this type of relationship with the technical teams. I understand it's a business model and we should be involved. How would you encourage them to transform their organization to connect to some of these points? And are there some specific connection points for specific roles you would drive those users toward?
Yeah. In the last chapter of the book, I talk about the fact that like these different guiding principles. And one of them is like having a top-down vision for what success really looks like. And that's not new. That's a great business thing. But in a SaaS setting, it becomes especially significant, because what I really want to be able to say is I want these product people and those marketing and these other roles that might have somehow, and operations even, viewed themselves outside the development or downstream of the development of the solution, to be more directly embedded in sort of thinking about how their role is now influenced by the fact that they're going to be running a SaaS business, that they're selling a service. This is one of the points I make in the book quite a bit, is you're selling a service, you're not selling a product. And part of the top-down vision is, how do I get these different roles, both the tech roles and the non-tech roles, to think about the fact that we're building and selling a service, and how does that affect what goes in the backlog? How does that affect how the tech team thinks about, well, what does it mean to build scale and resilience? Well, I have to have a sense of what kind of service experience I'm trying to deliver. And I need product people and operations people to be my right-hand people in this view. And I want management valuing from both of us, like time to value for customers and these operational metrics and our ability to scale and achieve agility. I want that to be something the business is holding us collectively accountable for in a way that makes product, ops, tech, all accountable to this broader sense of we're delivering to a service mindset. And so I'm actually pushing tech in another direction as much as I'm pushing prod and the others, right? But to me, as an example, I always give is like, if I'm a product person who traditionally worked with features and functions as my primary deliverable, now I'm thinking about time to value and like, how could noisy neighbor be potentially affecting our tiering strategy? And what kind of tiering strategy should we have? And what are the cost efficiencies we get out of supporting these different models? And the answers to those things are answered by technical directions as well. So the tech team has to be like, well, what kind of tiering strategy do you want? What would be a good model? And what kind of margins are we really trying to get? So both sides should be a little uncomfortable, I guess, in this process. And I want them surrounded by a vision or direction from the management that is saying, like, We have to succeed as a service, not just as a product.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now in its fifth season, Inspiring Tech Leaders is the podcast that talks about technology strategies, challenges, and breakthroughs shaping today's digital world. Each week, Inspiring Tech Leaders brings you technology reviews and interviews with visionary CIOs, CTOs, and industry pioneers. Whether you're leading a tech team or just love innovation, Inspiring Tech Leaders is your go-to source for inspiration and real-world advice. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform.
That's great. Now, I think a lot of the technologists on the call, speaking to the other side of this table, would be surprised when they read the book that they're not going to see EKS and serverless and or ECS or any of the technology-specific decisions until fairly late in the book. How would you help them? Because often we show up at a customer like, hey, we're an EKS shop. We want to build this in EKS. How would you sort of justify or explain to them why those technology decisions are so far downstream from these other decisions you want them to think about first?
It's a great question because I think a lot of people do start this like, well, we're going to SaaS, we're going to be containers, we're done, right? Like we're done. Are we chosen serverless? That's it. We're all good. And for me, it's like, well, why? Why is EKS the right fit? Why is serverless? Why is it not a mix of those things? Where would you use which technology, right? And for me, this drives back to being much more fine-grained in the questions you ask of your architecture, right? It's back to the silo pool question, even like, which resource to be dedicated, which resource should be shared. Well, it's not like a global decision for your whole product. It's this microservice might be siloed, but its data might be pooled. And those same sort of questions apply as you get later in the technology stage. Like, what are we really trying to achieve? What deployment models do we need to support? What tiering strategies do we need to support? What kind of economies of scale are we going to get? What's the nature of the workloads and like the way that tenants are going to push the system? Will some of those pieces be better supported by serverless, or will some of them be better supported by EKS? So for me, I don't ever want the question to start with like, we picked the tech, now let's figure out what our SaaS strategy is. Like that's sort of inverted for me. And I don't think people do it that. I'm sort of going to the extreme there. I think people are weighing the pros and cons, but they do tip a direction from the beginning without necessarily asking all the hard questions.
That's a great point. I don't think we can get through a talk without mentioning the word Gen AI. I know it comes in the book toward the end, and it's a newer topic that's evolving. But do you want to quickly sort of talk about how you think about Gen AI and how you would position it for anyone who's in their mind, like, hey, we're doing SaaS, we're trying to figure out the angle here. How would you position it with them?
Well, and Gen AI was the last chapter added to the book. It was not in the original outline for the book. And I definitely asked myself and the people around me at O'Reilly who are helping, like, I don't want to put a Gen AI chapter in the book just because everybody's talking about Gen AI. But we had the foundations of some really interesting ideas about, I think, what does Gen AI mean to SaaS providers? And there was enough meat on the bone that it went from sort of is this a whole chapter or is it a part of another chapter? It was clearly became its own chapter, and there was a lot more meat on the bone as I dug into the topic. And so really the idea here is not to look at Gen AI like generically for SaaS applications. This is the story with almost everything in the SaaS space and multi-tenant spaces. What is the way that multi-tenancy changes the way I design and develop my solution around this particular technology? And in this case with Gen AI, how do I offer targeted experiences to my tenants? Like we always do, like we use silo pool, all those other things to offer targeted experiences. What's the Gen AI version of that story? So where do I use RAG, or where do I use fine tuning? Where do I use knowledge bases? Where do I use all these other mechanisms, and even silo and pool and tiering and all noisy neighbor, all those things have a representation and a place that have to be addressed as you start looking at consuming these different technologies. And in reality, I feel like at the end of it all, I was thinking Gen AI could have a huge impact on some domains, and that it gives you a way to offer a distinct experience on a shared platform to individual tenants without having to, it's another flavor of economies of scale. If I'm in the e-commerce business and I sell to golf stores and tool companies and clothing stores, like what it means to search for a product or like interact with an individual store is could be different across each one of those spaces. But under the hood of that, that all could be served by one Gen AI experience. That's the fantasy version of it. I mean, I think the real world still has to prove out that those things are going to happen. But that's the scope of what's kind of in that chapter, is like, where, what's the overlay of multi-tenancy across these different Gen AI concepts? And it ends up being the case that there's lots of them, including like, how do you do pricing for a SaaS product that is using Gen AI? Like, what are you, the size of the prompts, and like, how are you dealing with that variability, and how are you going to calculate that and pass that cost along? Like there's lots of nuance in there.
So a lot of the, anyone who's listening and thought about reading the book is probably like, well, a lot of the stuff you're talking about is how I would build SaaS. Now, people who've already built SaaS and are running and operating a SaaS product today also have probably questions about the operations of SaaS. And in the past, we didn't talk about it as much, but I noticed you've got two or three chapters, I think, dedicated just to the operational side of SaaS, how you operate a SaaS solution. Do you want to sort of talk about what that experience is and how we think about that to anyone who's already built a SaaS solution?
Yeah, I mean, it is like one of the common themes is that we talk to lots of SaaS companies, we engage lots of SaaS companies, they're successful SaaS companies, they're doing well. But if you look at the bar we set for like metrics and analytics and operational insights and proactive policies and all these things we want to be able to do to say, hey, the more we share infrastructure, the more we have one unified environment for our customers, the more robust our operational insights have to be. And our operational insights can't just be, is it healthy or is it not healthy? Our operational insights have to be, hey, what's this one tenant doing that's affecting other tenants? Or what tenants of this tier doing that's affecting the SLA of the other tenants in the system? And so the scope of what you look at, the granularity of what you look at in a multi-tenant environment on that operational side is wildly different. And that's just through the tech view. Then you layer on top of that, the business now wants to know lots more about what are tenants doing? How are they consuming the system? What patterns are they consuming the system? How is this new feature going? Even down to like, how might we release new features and functions? And how might we think differently about how we stage and roll out waves of, you know, canary releases or AB, you know, whatever you want to sort of layer into that. So for me, you know, the bar is way higher for just like the risk to the business if you don't have robust operations. But B, the richness of information you can have in that environment can tell the business, the tech, the ops teams, we need to go add this stuff to our backlog of stuff that needs to get done, because we want to see problems before they're a problem for customers, and we want to be able to identify them. And we build all these cool scaling and resilience and all these other policies, but then new tenants are coming in, new features are coming in, and you want to know how the architecture and the environment is reacting and responding to these all these different stimuli, and be sure that you have the tools you need to sort of proactively see what's happening or just make good decisions about how to make it better. Like, maybe we're over provisioned on all kinds of things because the policies we adopted are wrong, but we don't know it till we like see it in the wild. Well, I want to know all that stuff. I want to have my finger on the pulse of all that. And I want the business people to want to have their fingers on the pulse of that.
Great answer. One final question, Todd. So you've already mentioned a couple of things I heard you talk about: cell-based architecture, how that might evolve, and Gen AI, how that might evolve. If you think we're going to write the sequel to this in 5 years, what are some of the topics that you think are really going to change over that time? And are there any new topics that are just like on the edge of your radar? You're like, I think it's not ready to talk about, but we're going to be talking about it later.
Well, there's a fantasy version of that to me, and there's a reality version of that. Because in the fantasy version of this, I'd like to think that these concepts, like if you take a concept like tenant isolation, for example, and you look at the way we have across the cloud vendors, right? Lots of sort of managed services which hide all the detail of their implementation to us, but they haven't totally infused all of these multi-tenant concepts into the services directly. Even the notion of a control plane, right, could be something that becomes more standardized. We already see people, in fact, building control planes. We see partners building control planes. So for me, the fantasy version is that like the scope and the nature of what a multi-tenant developer will have to do in the future, and the complexity of what they'll have to tackle, the scale, the resilience of it, will be a smaller footprint than it is today. You'll have less things you have to think about, and that how to get some of these complex problems to work won't require all the nuanced things that we have to talk about and all the questions we have to ask. So I feel like a longer term version of this would be like, well, then how are we now extending the capabilities of what SaaS brings both to the business and to customers that it couldn't achieve before? Like, are we able to release new features even faster than before? Are we innovating faster? And so the capabilities of all these solutions are suddenly growing at a much faster rate before. And as the price model, the approachability, the ability to sort of get that value at a reduced price point, going to come down, right? Like, I feel like SaaS is also going to find its way even deeper into domains where people think it wouldn't go. So I feel like all kinds of industries said they would not be SaaS that are now SaaS now. I think that wave will just continue, and it will be accepted. So compliance and security and tenant isolation, all these things people will work about, will get resolved to the point where even more people will come in.
Great. Yeah, I think we're all looking forward to it. Simpler, faster, more broadly applicable SaaS is, I think, where we all like to go. Todd, thank you very much. This has been a great interview. Thank you for taking the time. And I hope everyone who's hasn't read it yet will reach out and read your book already.
Thanks. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.